Thank you for joining me. I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for January 25 and 26, 2013, from sundown to sundown. This Torah teaching is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com, themessianicmessage.com. I hope you enjoy this teaching. Before we get started, let's pray. Baruch atah Yehovah Eloheinu Melech haolam. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe, Creator of all things, and Giver of your Torah, your Word. Abba, I thank you for your Shabbat and for your people and for all of the works that you are doing on the earth and that you are trying to bring your people home. I pray that you will gather us home very, very soon. And Abba, I pray that during this teaching you would keep your hand on me as I speak, so that I do not speak anything that is not of you. I pray that my words will fall to the ground and yours will rise up and give fruit. I ask all this in the name of Yeshua. Amen. This week's teaching is called Beshalach. It means when he let go. It's Exodus chapter 13, starting in verse 17, to chapter 17, verse 16. The Haftarah is Judges 4, chapter 4, to chapter 5, verse 31. And the Brit Hadashah is John chapter 6, verses 22 to 40. So now we're in Beshalach, and those people have come out of Egypt now. They have just been released. And it says here that Beshalach means when he let go. Well, who is it that let go? Of course, it was Pharaoh. So the Pharaoh let them go. Now, one of the questions I've been talking about with people over the past couple of weeks is, did Pharaoh die? Was the Pharaoh a firstborn? In fact, Pharaoh was a firstborn, but his life was spared. We don't get this information in the book of Genesis. We get it from the book of Jasher, chapter 80, starting in verse 43, where it says, "And it came to pass in the middle of the night that the Lord went forth in the midst of Egypt and smote all the firstborn of the Egyptians, from the firstborn of man to the firstborn of beast. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great outcry throughout Egypt in that night, for there was not a house in which there was not a corpse. And the likenesses of the firstborn of Egypt, which were carved in the walls at their houses, were destroyed and fell to the ground. Even the bones of their firstborn who had died before this, and whom they had buried in their houses, were raked up by the dogs of Egypt on that night and dragged before the Egyptians and cast before them." But this Egyptian was a firstborn, and we read this down in verse 7 of chapter 80, where it says, "Moses said to Pharaoh, behold, you are your mother's firstborn, yet fear not, for you will not die, for the Lord has commanded that you shall live, in order to show you his great might and strong stretched out arm." So the Lord spared Pharaoh so that this Pharaoh could have the Red Sea experience. And of course, that Red Sea experience was much different for Pharaoh than it was for the Lord's people. Let's go to Exodus chapter 13, verse 17. "And it came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God led them not through the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God had said, lest peradventure the people repent when they see war, and they return to Egypt. But God led the people about through the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went up harnessed out of the land of Egypt." Now that word harnessed there is Strong's 2571. It is kamash, and it means in battle array, arrayed for battle by fives, armed and so forth. Back in the old English days, when you harnessed an army, what that was is they were harnessed to weaponry and different things like that. They went up harnessed with their weapons on their bodies and so forth, and they called that being harnessed. And then we even saw in the Civil War that they would harness men to cannons and so forth. So we have this old word here that nobody understands anymore, but it means that they went out armed. So since the Hebrews were equipped for that battle, why would God not want his children to take that route? After all, they were going to head for a battle with the Egyptians. So whether they fought the Philistines or they fought the Egyptians, what was the difference? Why was the Red Sea route a better one? Well, first of all, in verse 17, it says that the Lord did not want them to repent and return to Egypt. You see, the way that they were going, if they had gone toward the Philistine country, it would have been easier for them to turn around. There would have been no way for the Lord to get them pinned against the wall there at Red Sea in order for him to show both them and the Egyptians his final judgment. He was not done yet. And if they had gone by the way of the Philistine territory, he would not have been able to show them his judgment against the Egyptians, because that would have resulted in the Israelites fighting both the Philistines on the front and the Egyptians on the back. And at this point, the Lord does not have a problem with the Philistines yet. They haven't been the folks that have been keeping the Israelites in bondage. And if they had gone by the way of Philistines, Israel would have won, because the Lord would have, you know, shown them his might in battle, but they would have taken the glory for it. That's the human way. They would have probably taken the glory for it, and then he would not have gotten the glory for winning. So you can see why it was important for the Lord to lead them in the way that he did, because he needed to complete the job with the Egyptians. But he also needed the Pharaoh to have a reason to follow the children of Israel in there. If the Pharaoh thought that he was going to have to go up against the Philistines, he might not have followed them. So the Lord wanted the children of Israel to appear to be wandering aimlessly in the desert. Let's go to Exodus chapter 14, verse 3. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, "They are entangled in the land, the wilderness has shut them in, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart that he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord." And they did so. You see, in our Exodus, there are going to be times when it's going to look hopeless to us, just like it did to the children of Israel. It's going to look like our enemies are closing in on us, but the Lord has a purpose in that. He needs not only us to know that he is God, but he needs our enemies to know that he is God. And so the Lord needed Pharaoh to come and chase the children of Israel, and he might not have done that if they were headed towards the Philistines. So there were several reasons why the Lord did not take the children of Israel around what they call the easy route. It would have been much easier, yes, in some respects, but in the long run it would not have been, because the Lord would not have been able to put forth his name and get the glory that he deserves to get. In Exodus 13:20, says, "They took their journey from Sukkot and encamped in Etham, in the edge of the wilderness. So that first night was spent at Sukkot." And Sukkot is at the edge of the wilderness. You know, when we go into the wilderness of the peoples, we're going to start at Sukkot. But that's not the wilderness. We're going to move from Sukkot to another place, and that's where we're going to be in the wilderness. Exodus 13:21, "And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, to go by day and night. He took not away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of fire by night from before the people." Now, these pillars of cloud and fire were related to the fire and smoke from the burning remnants of lambs back there in the land of Egypt. Exodus 14:13. And Moses said to the people, "Fear you not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." So what he's saying here is, see the Yeshua of the Lord, and that is the name of our Messiah. Verse 15, And the Lord said to Moses, "Wherefore criest you unto me? Speak to the children of Israel that they go forward. But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." Now, you know that those folks were scared to death running between those walls of water. Or were they? We'll see here in a minute that they might not have been seeing those walls of water. Exodus 14:17. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. And I will get me honor upon Pharaoh, upon all his host, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. Now, we're going to look at this word honor. It is kabod. That means also glory. So he's going to get glory from his defeat of Pharaoh. You see, this is why he did not take them through the Philistine wilderness, because he didn't have a fight with the Philistines. His fight was with Pharaoh, and he had to finish this off. He works with us for his name's sake. He delivers us for his name's sake. He shows the world who he is for his name's sake. And so that's what this whole Red Sea thing was about. It was about his name's sake, him finishing up the job and not picking a fight with people that he didn't have a fight with at the moment, and showing the children of Israel his great glory and that he can deliver them. Exodus 14:18. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten me honor or kabod or glory upon Pharaoh, upon his chariots, and upon his horsemen. So again, it isn't just that he wants us to know he is God, but also everyone else. Now, I'm going to share with you something that I did not see before. My friend Teresa showed me this, starting in verse 19. And the angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near the other all night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right and on their left. See, look, they were traveling across the Red Sea at night. Verse 21 says the strong east wind caused the water to go back all that night. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea. They went in at night, which is why, you know, we always see it depicted as happening during the daytime. And of course, if it happened during the day, it probably would be very scary. But in the night, it just looked like walls on the right and on the left. But here's what's happening. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them to the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass that in the morning watch, the Lord looked to the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the hosts of the Egyptians. I used to think that the children of Israel, as I said before, were waiting all night until the morning to cross the Red Sea. But now, Teresa pointed this out to me. I can see now that they were actually crossing the Red Sea during the night with the pillar of cloud behind them. And while they were crossing, the pillar of cloud was moving along, and that was luring the Egyptians into position between the walls of water. And it would make more sense, because if the Egyptians had seen this happen during the daytime, they would have seen the walls of water. It wouldn't have looked to them just like walls there in the darkness, you see. So it wasn't until in the morning, in verse 24, it says it came to pass that in the morning that, you know, they got all troubled and upset about what was going on, and they realized their precarious position. And this is why they suddenly got all stirred up. And in verse 25 it says, and took off their chariot wheels that they drave them heavily. So they were going so hard that their chariot wheels came off, because suddenly they could see now it's morning, it's daylight, and they're in the midst of these walls of water. So the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. So they were trying to flee from between those walls of water that they hadn't seen in the dark, and that they could only see in the morning light, but they couldn't get out. And so they lost their chariot wheels, and then that water came in on them. Can you imagine the panic in the army of Pharaoh? Verse 29, but the children of Israel walked upon dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So it was a wall to them on their right and on their left. It doesn't say a wall of water. They did not recognize what was on their right or on their left. And now they're standing on the banks on the other shore, on the other side. They're standing on that bank, and they're seeing what's happening to the Egyptians. Verse 30, thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. And Israel saw that great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. And so now the Lord has accomplished his goal. The Egyptian army is gone, and the Egyptians know that Jehovah is God, and the children of Israel now know that Jehovah is God. Let's go to Exodus chapter 15, verse 1. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song to the Lord, and spoke, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. His horse and rider has he thrown into the sea. Immediately afterwards, after this Red Sea event, there is now a great praise and worship session going on. And that's how it's supposed to be. It would not be fitting for them to have just continued into the desert without praising the Lord. Now, this is fit for us to do from day to day, for the little things and the big things that the Lord does for us. And it's also going to be very fit for us to do praise and worship to the Lord for his great deliverance when he delivers us back to the land of Israel. Verse 13 and 14, you in your mercy have led forth the people which you have redeemed. You have guided them in your strength to your holy habitation. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall take hold on the inhabitants of Palestina. So first the Lord redeemed them. Then he took them out into the wilderness to take them to his holy habitation. And that is the salvation process. He redeems us. Then he guides us through the wilderness so that we can take a look at who we really are And that's going to be also the purpose of the 10 tests that are coming, so that we will know who we truly are and what we truly believe, what is truly in our hearts. You know, the Lord doesn't need to know what's in our hearts. He already knows what's in our hearts. But He needs us to go through the wilderness so that we will know what's in our hearts, so that He can take us to His holy habitation. Now, the far-reaching effect is that not only now do the children of Israel and the Egyptians know that Jehovah is God, but also all of the other people in the regions, in that region, knows that He is God. And here they use the word Palestina. And that word is actually Pleshet. And Pleshet means rolling or migratory. So this is not talking specifically about the Philistines, but all of those migratory peoples that were inhabiting Canaan at the time, all the way north to the region that today we call Syria. Exodus 15:15. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed. The mighty men of Moab, trembling, shall take hold upon them. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall melt away. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. By the greatness of your arm they shall be as still as a stone, till your people pass over, O Lord, till the people pass over which you have purchased. You shall bring them in and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, in the place, O Lord, which you have made for you to dwell in the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands have established. The Lord shall reign for ever and ever. Now let's stop and take a look at this for a little bit, because here we're talking about the place where the Lord has made His sanctuary to be in. Now, this is an allusion to, of course, Jerusalem and Temple Mount. And this is part of the song that Moses is singing, but this praise and worship song that includes this allusion to the sanctuary being in Jerusalem is called the Song of Moses. Now, there is another Song of Moses as well in Deuteronomy, and both of those songs pertain to us here at the end. But let's take a look at the predictions of verses 17 and 18. Because it says that the Lord shall reign forever and ever. Well, that has not been fulfilled yet. Yes, eventually the children of Israel became the inhabitants of the area, and they established His dwelling place, His sanctuary, the place on that mountain of His inheritance where He wanted to have His name established. Eventually, they did do that, but remember, they got kicked out. Thus, the Lord has not reigned there forever and ever yet. And that is part of the purpose of the second coming and of also the greater Exodus. Now, we're going to get into the 10 tests, and we're going to, in this Torah portion, have only 3 of them. But this deliverance that we just learned about in the wilderness there at the Red Sea, that was test number 1. And the question in that test is, will God really deliver us? Well, we get the answer to this in Exodus 15:22. So Moses brought the children of Israel from the Red Sea. See, they're moving on. Moses brought them from the Red Sea and they went out into the wilderness. So our answer to question number 1, to test number 1, will God really deliver us, is really right here in verse 22, where it says that they moved on into the wilderness of Shur. Now, if they had not been delivered, they would not have been able to move on into the wilderness of Shur. So the question then is answered. But immediately, as they have gone 3 days in the wilderness, they have not found water. And in verse 23, it says, then they came to Marah. Okay, this is going to provide them with test number two. It says in verse 23 that they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah, or bitter. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" So test number two is, will God provide water for us? And Moses, that it says in verse 25, and he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast it into the waters were made sweet. There he made for them a statute and an ordinance, and there he proved them. So what he's doing again is testing them. And verse 26, and said, "If you will diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord your God, and will do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon you which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that heals you." And I've taught in past Torah portions that the tree that Moses threw in there was probably Moringa oleifera. In fact, that Moringa oleifera is used to sweeten water in the East and in Africa to this day. It was tested in the 1970s as a treatment for bitter or polluted water, and the tests came out great. So Moringa oleifera probably what the Lord had Moses put in there. But the Lord provided water where there was none, right here at Marah, and then he took them to water that was already available, but that they did not yet know existed. Verse 27, and they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the waters. So Marah was the water that did not exist, because they did not have the means to drink it until it was cleaned. Oh, and this water at Elim is the water that was available, but that they did not know existed. So this shows us a little bit about ourselves, how the Lord can work with what we can see in front of us, how he can clean up our circumstances and provide for us, but that he also has the ability to take us to what is already available that we don't know exists. And then there's test number three, starting in Exodus 16, verse 1. And they took their journey from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, "Would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For you have brought us forth to this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." You see, God wants to know if you know that he's going to feed you when you follow him without question. And you know, he has the right to know this. He has the right for you to know that you're going to follow him without question and without complaint. And so we see here, test number three is, will the Lord feed us? Verse 4. Then said the Lord to Moses, "Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain rate every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no." Now, in verse 4, we're going to learn that he has a plan. He says he wants to prove them whether they will obey him or not. And there are certain things that he's going to say that he wants to see if they will obey him or not. One is that on the sixth day, they are to gather twice as much as they gather daily. And that when they gather, they are not to leave any on the shelf because it will rot. And so the Lord wants to know if they are going to follow His instructions. And I'm going to share a little bit more of those instructions with you in a minute. But you'll see that in verse 8, it says that Moses said, "This shall be when the Lord shall give you in the evening flesh to eat, and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your murmurings, which you murmur against Him." And what are we? That's Moses and Aaron. "Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord." You know, He's right. When people have a problem with a leader, it really isn't with the leader that they're having a problem. The problem that they're having is that they don't want to go to the Lord with their complaint. So part of a leader's job is to receive the complaints that are against the Lord. Actually, that is within our pay grade. But we, as leaders, then need to pass the complaint on up the ladder to the Lord, because we can't fix the complainer's problems. We have to take those complaints to the Lord. Now, it would be better, and it's more proper, if the people would learn to take their complaints directly to the Lord and not lay these things on the leaders. But that's one of the things that the Lord makes it possible for the leaders to withstand. Verse 9. And Moses spoke to Aaron, "Say to the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for He has heard your murmurings." And it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. You see, the Lord wants to approach His people. I'm sure, though, that He would much rather do it by being praised by them rather than having them murmur and complain. Verse 11, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at evening you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God." First of all, one of the false teachings that I heard my many, many years in my life was that the only thing these people had to eat out there in the wilderness was manna. Well, that's not true. It says right here in this chapter that they ate flesh in the evening, and in the morning they were filled with bread, and that bread, of course, was the manna. But again, the Lord is trying to get the people to know that He is God. The reason He wants to approach us when we're not complaining is because He doesn't want to have to keep proving to us that He is the Lord our God. Murmuring and complaining keeps our relationship with Him in that category. It's like we're relegating Him to being just a sugar daddy for us. No, He wants us to know that He is our God so that we can move past this low rung on the ladder and move on up to better things with Him. But when He has to continually show us His glory in relation to a complaint, we continue to keep Him relegated to this lowest rung of the ladder and this lowest place in our hearts. Exodus 16:13. "And it came to pass that at evening the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host. And when the dew that lay was gone up, behold, upon the face of the wilderness there lay a small round thing, as small as the hoar frost on the ground. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, it is manna, for they wist not what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat." A time would come when the bread of the Lord would walk around in the flesh, and the children of Israel of that day would not recognize what it was then either. 2,000 years later, people still do not recognize the bread of life, the manna from the Lord. You see, Yeshua is that manna. He is that bread of life that was given to us to eat. John 6:51 says, I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I will give is my flesh, which I give for the life of the world. So this manna that came down from heaven, that was the bread of life. That was Yeshua giving of himself. And in verse 52, the Jews therefore strove among themselves, saying, How can this man give us his flesh to eat? Then Yeshua said to them, Verily, verily, I say to you, except you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you have no life in you. You know, today even, there are those who still refuse to eat of this bread. They refuse to eat of him. They cry that they are hungry like the children of Israel in the wilderness, but they won't eat the bread he provided. They will only eat the puff pastries that their poorly learned pastors feed them. The Torah is their bread. You see, he was and is the Torah in flesh. The Torah is the bread. It is also the manna. He is the manna. The Torah is the manna, because they're all one and the same. But they don't know what it is, even as the children of Israel in the wilderness don't know what this manna is. They're looking at it and they say, What is it? That's what manna means. They don't know what it is, and we still have this problem today. Okay, back to Exodus 16, verse 17. And the children of Israel did so, and gathered, some more, some less. And when they did mete it out with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over, and he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. You see, right here is what the Lord was talking about there in John chapter 6, verses 51 to 53. Because no matter, just if you take a little, you'll be full. And if you take a lot, you'll be full. You won't be able to take more than what you can handle. And that's what happened with the manna. If they took a lot, they didn't have more than they needed. And if they took less, they had as much as they needed, you see? And that's the way it is with the Torah. And Moses said, Let no man leave of it till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not to Moses. Some of them left of it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was wroth with them. Some that gathered and had only as much as could be eaten also put some aside. Why would they do that? Well, it was their way of saying that they didn't believe the Lord would give them more tomorrow. So, they had their amount that they required for the day. Not too much, not too little. But some of those ate less than they needed and saved the rest in case of some dire emergency, you know, when the Lord didn't show up to do his thing for them, you see. That's a slap in the face to the Lord. And that's why the manna rotted during their sleeping time at night. The lesson in this is to take and use what the Lord provides for us today and not worry about tomorrow. You see, he said that, not for us to worry about tomorrow. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 34, it says, these are the Lord's words, Take, therefore, no thought for the morrow, for the morrow will take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. So, if we believe that he is providing for our needs, then we need to act like it by not taking more or less than our needs require, which was the instruction he gave regarding the manna. To take more of his provision than is needed, is to show the Lord that we don't believe he will provide for us again tomorrow, and to take less is to be in rebellion, kind of like going on a hunger strike against your situation. He wants each of us to have enough, and enough is not too little or too much. Now here is our first Shabbat instruction. Exodus 16, verse 23. And he said to them, "This is that which the Lord has said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake that which you will bake today, and seethe that you will seethe, and that which remains over lay up for you to be kept until the morning." And they laid it up until the morning as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither was there any worm therein. So you see, we get our first lesson here that we're not to perform the labor of cooking on Shabbat. We're to prepare the day before Shabbat and not be concerned about cooking on the Shabbat. But the other lesson here is that he provides for Shabbat. We don't ever have to worry about not having enough to eat on Shabbat. So the manna that came on the sixth day, unlike on the other days, was enough for 2 days. Verse 25, and Moses said, "Eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you shall not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none." And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. Oh, these are such unbelievers and rebellious. They're going to do what they want to do when they want to do it. Verse 28, and the Lord said to Moses, "How long refuse you to keep my commandments and my laws?" That's a very good question, since we're still disobeying 4,000 years later. Each one of us in our own lives has to answer this one. Verse 29 says that we are to stay in place. Now let's go read that. "See, for that the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide you, every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day." Now, let's take a look at that Hebrew word for place in that verse 29. It's Strong's 8478, and it means bottom, below, or underneath. The word is takat. And bottom, below, or underneath is not telling us that we're to stay in our homes on Shabbat. We know that Shabbat is a holy convocation. Later on, we're going to read that several places, that it's a holy convocation. But when you read this in context here, what he is saying is don't go out of your place looking for the manna. Don't go doing your own thing on Shabbat. That's what the context here is. Takat, bottom, below, or underneath, means to stay in our place of humility before the Lord. He has provided our manna on the sixth day for the seventh day. See, I'm recording this teaching on the sixth day. But most people are going to listen to it on the seventh day. This teaching is enough for the sixth day and the seventh day. The manna was enough for the sixth day and the seventh day. There was no reason for them to go out of their homes trying to find some other manna. You see, it's not about you have to stay in your room and stay on your bed and just sleep all day. That's the way some people teach this, but it's about our humility before the Lord and us not trying to force our will on the Sabbath. So takat is meant to instruct them to simply trust him and stop complaining. Exodus chapter 16 verse 32. And Moses said, This is the thing which the Lord commands. Fill an omer of it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread wherewith I have fed you in the wilderness when I brought you forth from the land of Egypt. You know what? That's going to be a pretty special thing to see in the kingdom. That bread that didn't rot for 4,000 years. Yet, if you try to be rebellious and set some aside because you don't believe the Lord, it's going to rot. So, being able to see this bread when we get in the kingdom, and I do believe that it will be there because it was set aside for the generations. I believe it's going to be there and we're going to get to see it and see that it hasn't rotted for 4,000 years. This is pretty special stuff, this manna. And the children of Israel did eat manna 40 years until they came to a land inhabited. They did eat manna until they came to the borders of the land of Canaan. Again, what is our manna? Well, it's the Torah. We have to eat it now until we go to the land of our inheritance. We have to take inside ourselves, we have to ingest the Torah until we get to the land of our inheritance. But when we get to the land, we will no longer be eating Torah / manna. We will be receiving it directly from the mouth of the Torah made flesh. And I believe that our bodies will have been transformed into another kind of body that is composed of the same components of Yeshua, who is the Torah. We will no longer have a need to eat the Torah because we will be individual Torahs in bodies on the earth. We will no longer sin because our new bodies will be the same as Yeshua's, who is the Torah. In 1 John chapter 3, verse 2, it says, Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. You see, so if his body is composed of the Torah, then ours will be composed of the Torah too. He does not sin, so neither will we. Therefore, we will not continue eating Torah / manna as we do now, but we will be in bodies who are living Torahs. Unlike what is going on now, try as we might, we are not in that state yet. Then in verses 33 to 36, it talks about them setting apart the omer. And in verse 36, it says that the omer is the tenth part of an ephah. So what they did was they took up one-tenth or a tithe of that first manna. So that's the first time that there was a tithe made as a nation to the Lord. And in chapter 17, there is another water test. Chapter 17, verse 1. And all the congregation of Israel journeyed from the wilderness of Sin after their journeys according to the commandment of the Lord and pitched in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. Wherefore the people did chide with Moses and said, Give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, Why chide you with me? Wherefore do you tempt the Lord? And the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, Wherefore is this that you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our cattle with thirst? You see, they got it wrong the first time. They failed it. And so the Lord is going to test them again. This is test number 2 with the water. We're going to have another water test later on. So we're going to have 3 times where the water has become a test. The water is representative of the living water. These people are not doing very well with the tests of the living water. They're not understanding from where their water is coming. Verse 4, And Moses cried to the Lord, saying, What shall I do to this people? They be almost ready to stone me. And the Lord said to Moses, Go on before the people, and take with you of the elders of Israel, and your rod, wherewith you smote the river, take in your hand, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there upon the rock in Horeb, and you shall smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the chiding of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, Is the Lord among us or not? So they still don't truly trust the Lord. But events must continue to unfold. Tests must continue to unfold, and so he moves them on. The Lord is going to try to continue getting these people to see who he is. So he's going to bring a battle with the Amalekites so that they can see that result and learn to trust him through that test. You see, these tests just show us that none of us truly trust the Lord yet. Exodus 17, verse 8. Then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And Moses said to Joshua, Choose us out men and go fight. And go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses had said to him, and he fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up the hill, up to the top of the hill. And it came to pass, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed, and when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So when that staff was up, Israel prevailed, and when the staff was down, Amalek prevailed. That staff is the Torah. So when the staff is up, when the Torah is up, the enemies cannot prevail. You know, when Yeshua was in the desert and he was being tempted by the adversary, the thing that he used to defeat the enemy was the Torah. As long as the Torah is up, we will prevail. Exodus 17:13. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword, and the Lord said to Moses, Write this for a memorial in a book, and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under the heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi, for he said, Because the Lord has sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Why was God so harsh with Amalek? Why did he swear to have war with Amalek in every generation? And why did he give us the commandment to blot out Amalek, and for us to not forget to blot out Amalek? Well, it's because Amalek attacked them when they were weak from thirst. You know, our tests are coming. In fact, people are being tested right now. But we have the answers that first generation did not have. And they might have had excuse, but we will not have any. So let us not fear, because the Lord will fight for us like he did for our ancestors, like he did for them against the Amalekites. I hope this has been a blessing to you. Shabbat Shalom.